This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, we'll talk with former UN Ambassador Samantha Power about the role of women in politics.
I had the experience at the White House of being in the minority and then getting to the UN, which is one of the most male-dominated institutions in the world.
Plus, a look at why more Coloradans are doubling up to find housing.
And we'll look at the new Office of Saving People Money on Healthcare. Is it doing what it promised?
That's coming up.
It's Monday, October 7th. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your daily look at news from around the state. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Lily Tyson, sitting in today for Henry Zimmerman. In September, the state of Colorado launched the Recovery Cards Project as part of the Lift the Label Opioid Anti-Stigma campaign. The Recovery Cards are free to Coloradans and offer a variety of illustrations and messages on them, including "I will never give up on you" or "We'll always have coffee."
Now, the state printed more than 10,000 cards of 34 different designs. Now there are only 6 designs left. They're currently printing new batches and expect they'll be back in stock in mid-October. Here to tell us more about the initiative is Elizabeth Owens. She is the Director of Policy and Communications for the Colorado Department of Human Services. Welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thank you for having me.
So why did the state originally launch this line of recovery cards?
The Recovery Cards Project really grew out of what we've heard from the people in our Lift the Label campaign, which has 29 Coloradans as part of the campaign sharing stories about addiction and recovery. And so we heard from those folks that people in addiction feel lonely and isolated. Friends and family don't know what to say. Maybe they want to be supportive, but they don't have the words. And that there's a stark difference between the community support available for other illnesses and the support for people and families battling addiction and loss.
So it seems kind of nice to just be able to shop for something that would have a message.
Absolutely. We want this to be like your normal greeting card store experience, where you go in, you have a message you want to send, the card provides the words. We're really trying to normalize the conversation here.
This is part of the Lift the Label campaign. Can you just briefly tell us about the campaign and a bit about why the state isn't just focused on recovery, but also on the stigma of addiction?
The Lift the Label campaign is really about removing the damaging labels and stigma that prevent people from accessing treatment for opioid addiction. And we know that stigma is a significant barrier in our state. It's one of, in the Colorado Health Access Survey, it's one of the top reasons that people cite for not receiving needed treatment for substance abuse. And so we launched the Lift the Label campaign to really get at that stigma, to make people feel comfortable talking about addiction, seeking treatment, asking for help, telling their friends and family members, and also to let friends and family members know that their loved one, that this isn't a choice, that their addiction should be met with support and that there are resources available in our state.
Why do you think they're so popular?
I think that these types of greeting cards generally are not widely available. People are like, these are the words that I wish I had, either to support a loved one, or this is what I wish someone had said to me while I was struggling with addiction, or it's what I wish someone would say to me today in recovery. The cards were really created with input from people in recovery, and 10 artists created the cards, and 4 of those artists are in recovery themselves, and all 10 of the artists have some story, you know, related to addiction. And so I think it's the authenticity of the cards. Like, people are, you know, reading these cards and they're like, that resonates with me. That's part of my story.
I love some of the messages on these. They're not, I mean, let's just say if you haven't seen them, they're not your typical get well cards.
Yeah, we really tried to address all different types of situations. We know that for some people, humor does resonate. For others, you know, more of that supportive message that, you know, there's nothing you could do that would ever make me give up on you, or I won't give up on you, or you can do this and your strength inspires me. So we really tried to, and then we also have the messages of loss as well. You know, we wanted there to be cards that supported someone if they've lost a loved one to addiction or to overdose.
Elizabeth Owens is the Director of Policy and Communications for the Colorado Department of Human Services Office of Behavioral Health. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
And as we've said, these cards aren't only for people in recovery. Some of them were actually designed by artists in recovery. That's the case with 4 of the 10 artists who created the 34 designs.
Now, we're going to talk with one of those artists now. Tabitha Aaron is a Boulder-based artist in recovery herself who designed some of the cards. Her designs include illustrations of animals, one of a wolf, another a butterfly, and she joins us now. Tabitha, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Can you just briefly walk us through the process of you designing one of these cards?
Yeah, I start with my original paintings. No, I'm a fine artist. I do fine art paintings and I use Venetian plaster. So I layer the plaster on with a palette knife using acrylic and layers of plaster. So it creates a lot of depth and texture at first. And it starts out kind of abstract. So I'm kind of free to explore. And then I take a lot of my own photographs of wildlife and I paint them in transparent form over the abstract, and it kind of creates a unique feeling and effect of depth and layers in our life that we have when we can all relate to an animal in some way.
What do these cards mean to Coloradans who are either in recovery or, you know someone, a friend or family member who's in recovery?
I think that means that it's okay to reach out, and I think that it's more meaningful than sending a text or an email. These cards are a way to kind of bring back the greeting cards and reach out and know that you're not alone. And I think that's one of the most important things in recovery is the support and connecting with others. And it really lifts the spirit and it will create more of a community.
And why do you think these cards have been so popular?
I think they've become popular because they're just uniquely created by all these artists that have had the experience and have passion for connecting people. And people are really craving connection. I think number one is like with the technology in the world we have, we just seem to have lost that personal touch. And that's why I think they're just a way and they're easily accessible and their campaign behind it is inspiring to others.
Tabitha Aaron is a Boulder-based artist who designed several of these cards for the state's Recovery Cards Project. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing a little bit about this.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be here and I'm happy to be a part of this.
Now let's take a look at today's headlines.
People who were abused by Catholic priests in Colorado are now eligible to receive unlimited payouts under a compensation program funded by the church. The fund's administrators say they were sending out packets to 65 people who previously came forward to report abuse. Anyone who hasn't contacted the Diocese of Colorado Springs, Denver, or Pueblo to report abuse has until November 30th to contact the Colorado Independent Reconciliation and Reparations Program. There are no fees to participate, and victims do not need to retain a lawyer.
Fall high school sports are underway, and Colorado athletic organizations are scrambling to find referees. The Greeley Tribune reports there's a statewide referee shortage affecting all sports. Few referees are signing up, partly because of poor fan behavior, low pay, and travel demands. Football, basketball, and softball have seen the greatest drop in referees. The Colorado High School Activities Association recently approved raises for basketball and soccer officials beginning this school year.
Flags remain at half staff to honor a Colorado lawmaker known for championing diversity and education during his 14 years in the state house. Colorado Politics reports Leo Lucero passed away last week. A memorial service was held over the weekend. The Pueblo Democrat and former Marine was 91.
Now we'll take a look at another initiative of the Polis administration.
Governor Jared Polis is getting praise and scorn for creating two new government offices this year. Democrats call him a, quote, mover and shaker, while Republicans question the use of tax dollars to expand bureaucracy. KUNC Scott Frantz looks at one of the offices to see if it's as innovative as Polis claims.
8 months ago, Governor Polis signed an executive order creating an office with a name that initially made some lawmakers laugh.
The Office of Saving People Money on Healthcare will form the beating heart of our efforts to reduce patient costs for hospital stays, for expenses.
And at his request, Democratic lawmakers also approved a $75,000 raise for Lieutenant Governor Diane Primavera to lead the effort.
There's a lot of departments across state government that handle health care, but there's been no office until today dedicated to helping us save money on health care.
But Polis is overlooking what some of his predecessors have already done. Governor Bill Ritter signed an executive order a decade ago, also creating an office that would, quote, improve the quality of health care and contain costs.
This is our lobby area.
And inside a Cherry Creek skyscraper, you'll find 24 people who are still working in the Center for Improving Value in Healthcare, or CIVIC.
Our organization is providing data that would inform how they want to actually put policies into place and put programs into place that could actually save people money, as the name implies.
Carrie Frank is the communications director. She says their goals are pretty much identical to the new office Polis created.
Improving healthcare in general, improving the quality of care and improving lives, and then also lowering the cost.
CIVIC was a government entity until 2011, when another governor, John Hickenlooper, signed his own executive order saying it was successful enough to stand on its own as a nonprofit. But it's still receiving state money, more than $4 million this year, for a variety of efforts.
We're ramping up what we're providing for all state agencies, not just the governor's office or Medicaid, but the Division of Insurance, you know, the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment.
But their data is helping to lower costs. Frank cites a hospital in Walsenburg that lowered the number of people visiting its ER.
They were getting a lot of people, like 7 o'clock and later, coming in, and most of them were on Medicaid, and they had jobs where they couldn't take time off during the day, and so they were coming to the ER as their source of care, essentially. So they decided that they needed to expand their primary care office hours for the outpatient clinic that they had.
Consumers can also access the information to find out which medical facility is offering the lowest price for, say, a knee replacement around the state. All this might have you wondering, what's the difference between this office and the one Governor Polis created?
So that was simply a data solution. It was one of the things that can be actually helpful in reducing costs of healthcare. What Bill Ritter did is essentially establish CIVIC, which is an all-payer claims database that our Office of Saving People Money can use that information. Insurers, Division of Insurance, Commissioner, all of those folks. There's no question that that was a constructive step, only insofar as we use that data, but it is very helpful to have that data out there from the CIVIC system that is the all claims database.
What does this office look like day to day, and what are the things you guys are working on?
Really, what it does is we focus on coordinating between all the different agencies that oversee healthcare. Healthcare is really big. So the question is, how can we do more, make our dollars go further, look at the cost drivers, whether it's hospital fees, the fact that we pay 5 to 8 times as much for the same prescription drug, too much for insurance, all of those different things. And we want to coordinate that in one area where we can apply that lens of saving people money across all the different areas of healthcare.
Polis says the Office of Saving People Money on Healthcare has held 14 listening sessions around the state to explore a public health insurance option. Lawmakers think it could increase competition in the market and lower costs. It's expected to come up in the next legislative session starting in January. I'm Scott Franz at the State Capitol.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC.
We've heard a lot about the struggle of finding affordable housing here in Colorado. And today we're going to bring you a look at a solution that more and more Coloradans are turning to.
It's called doubling up, and it basically means that more adults are living with other people to help find and pay for affordable housing in our state. Here to tell us more is Kevin Simpson. He's a writer for the Colorado Sun. Hi, Kevin.
It's great to be here.
What can you tell us about how many Coloradans are doubling up to find housing?
Well, we know there's a lot of them, and the number has increased since just before the recession. There was a study done that looked at census data from 2006 and compared it to the same data from 2017 and found that, you know, as we were heading into the Great Recession, about 1 in 5 households had doubled up. Now it's 1 in 4. So that's a pretty significant increase in terms of total numbers, over 500,000 people.
Does this just have to do with the availability of affordable housing in our state, or is there something more going on?
Well, that's probably one of the biggest factors. There are certainly other things that come into play. For instance, in some ways, it's culturally preferable for families, extended families, to live together. You often see this in immigrant communities in particular. So that plays into it as well. But I also think that you're right. The affordable housing crunch has made it a necessity for a lot of people.
So just to be clear, this is more than just family members living together.
Oh, definitely. It's, you know, everything from roommates that are just getting together, banding together, finding each other on social media. So you can go in together and maybe afford something that individually you never would have been able to afford. There are also programs out there now that look to match up adult individuals with older adults who maybe are having, you know, difficulty or need help staying in their home. They want to age in place, but they perhaps they've lost a spouse, or, you know, they don't have extended family around them. So they're amenable to having someone come in at a reduced rent who can also help around the house a bit.
And in your reporting, you talked to many people who are doubling up. Are there any stories that stood out to you that you could share with our listeners?
Well, one in particular that I found interesting was we had one young woman who, you know, wanted to go out, find a roommate, and you know, get out of her parents' house. She had a job and started looking at the rental market and realized that there was nothing really very affordable out there. And so she thought, well, shoot, if I'm going to rent at that price, maybe I could afford to buy at that price. So she had an advantage in her corner was a dad who's a contractor. And so they went actually looking for a property that might be, if not a fixer-upper, something that maybe had some anomaly about its design that would lend itself to their advantage. And what they found was a two-bedroom condo in downtown Denver that had a kind of a sitting area that, with the erection of one wall, could be made into a third bedroom. And so instead of having just a single roommate, she could have two roommates. And then she set about finding the roommates, which she did. She found a woman from New York and a woman from Seattle, two cities that have their own housing issues. And they came in and are her roommates now, and she was able to purchase the condo. So now, instead of just, you know, having roommates and paying rent, she's actually making an investment and has equity.
So then what happens if these groups of people start to break up and not live together anymore?
Well, that's the thing that the report's authors, Jennifer Newcomer and Phyllis Resnick, that they really get at is what happens when you inevitably break up. In the case of roommates, you know, in their first jobs or whatever, they eventually want to go their separate ways, have their own space. And what does that do to the demand for housing? I think just last spring, we were starting to feel that maybe the tight housing market was loosening up a little bit. But what the study cautions us about is that this tendency to double up could really be masking some latent demand. So, you know, there actually may be more demand out there than we're seeing right now. And over time, it's going to seep out and perhaps prolong the housing crisis.
Kevin Simpson is a writer with the Colorado Sun. You can find a link to his reporting on our homepage, kunc.org. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
One 100 years ago, the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution acknowledged women's right to vote. Over this next year, until August 2020, states around the country will commemorate the women's suffrage movement with educational events and community engagement.
Here in Colorado, the initiative is being led by History Colorado, which includes a speaker series called Bold Women, Change History. Speaking at one of their events this evening in Denver is Samantha Power. She is the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and a professor of the practice of global leadership and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. She has a new book out. It's called The Education of an Idealist, a memoir.
We reached her by phone to talk about her experience as a diplomat and the importance of women having a seat at the political table. She began by telling us about what this centennial for the 19th Amendment means to her.
First of all, the fact that women have the vote didn't come about by accident, and it's a reminder that when power gets dispersed or more equally shared, it's usually clawed for and fought for. And so, you know, one thing it means is just a lot of women put an awful lot on the line, a lot of men as well, in fact, supporting those women to make that happen. And I think it's a reminder today that we have to work for the change we seek. A lot of people are despairing about different aspects of our present. And I think there are some lessons that we can learn from the people who came out and just didn't give up.
What do you see as the importance of women being in the political sphere and, you know, having a seat at that table?
I had the experience at the White House of being in the minority and then getting to the UN, which is one of the most male-dominated institutions in the world. But in both environments, one can create a critical mass of women working on particular issues. And when that happens, so for example, at the UN Security Council, I was often the only female ambassador among 15 ambassadors seated on the Security Council. Through rotation, at one point, I became one of six women ambassadors, the most in the history of the UN Security Council, and the most in 70 plus years. 6 out of 15 was the record. I mean, that's not saying all that much. But when women were concentrated and when we were together, I think it changed the tenor of our debates. And so I can only speak from my experience. I think it is just really important. It stands to reason that 50% of the planet should be represented at all the highest decision-making bodies. But also then there are just qualities that you can't really overgeneralize, but that can actually create more inclusive, more respectful, and more productive debates and decision-making.
I'd like to ask your thoughts on the state of diplomacy now under President Trump.
The state of diplomacy under Trump is downright alarming. We have seen some of the most talented professionals in the American Foreign Service, in our diplomatic corps, leave the government. The constant disparagement of what President Trump calls the deep state, which is so unfair to these very, very technical, country-specific experts and functional experts who comprise the ranks of the bureaucracy. But to be ridiculed like that, but also just to be excluded, and for their voices and their perspectives on countries that some of the political appointees know almost nothing about, I think it just gets to be too much, not least also then the insults of our allies going ahead and ripping up all of these international agreements, which are so important to our security and the security of our kids and grandkids. I think some of them just couldn't take it anymore. So the ranks have been depleted. The number of people taking the Foreign Service exam also, so the people who will replenish the ranks, that number has dropped precipitously, where there are still more than 40 countries where the United States doesn't even have an ambassador, you know, nearly 3 years into this administration. So it's really going to be a very, very large hole that the next president will have to dig out of.
Just shifting to ask you about your book, your memoir is titled The Education of an Idealist. And I'm wondering why that title, and would you still call yourself an idealist?
I am definitely still an idealist. I am an unrepentant idealist. In some ways, that question begs the question of what is an idealist? And for me, I guess it has a couple components. I mean, one, do you like what you see right now? If not, if there are a set of standards and norms and principles that you think America should live by at home and abroad, that's a set of ideals against which current conduct is measured. And then the second step, in a way, is, okay, if you don't like what you see, if your ideals feel like they are being violated or abandoned or breached in some way, do you feel that there's anything you personally can do about it? Everybody sort of probably these days, or many, many people, would count themselves an idealist of the first kind. And I think that on the second front, the question a lot of people have is, well, yeah, I would love to do something about it, but what can one person do, really, next to the kind of inequality we face, the racial injustice, climate change, the 70 million people displaced around the world? And so the reason I wrote the book that I did was I wanted to describe my own evolution as I sought to project human rights and promote human rights. I wanted to show what I learned as I went about, again, trying to navigate that difficult system, a system with a lot of inertia kind of pushing back and a lot of gravity cutting in the other direction, but to make a difference. And even though my book inevitably talks about Boko Haram and LGBT rights and political prisoners in Syria, so in other words, a number of foreign policy issues, the spirit of the book is really about citizenship as well. It is how do we conquer our doubts that we ourselves can exercise agency in a manner that makes a difference.
Well, Samantha Power is a former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., professor of the practice of global leadership and public policy at Harvard Kennedy School. Her new book is The Education of an Idealist, a memoir. Ambassador, it's such a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Colorado Edition, we'll hear about a Greek organization whose mission is inclusivity. I'm Lily Tyson, sitting in for Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Brian Larson is our executive producer. Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.